Vimes spent the following morning trying to learn about two foreign countries. One of them turned out to be called Ankh-Morpork. Oberwald was easy. It was 5 or 6 times bigger than the whole of the Stowe Plains and stretched all the way up to the hub. It was so thickly forested, so creased by little mountain ranges and beset by rivers, that it was largely unmapped. It was mostly unexplored too. Well, at least by proper explorers, just living there doesn't count. The people who lived there had other things in their mind, and the people from outside who came to explore went into the forests and never came out again. And for centuries no one had bothered about the place. You couldn't sell things to people hidden by too many trees. It was probably the coach road that had changed everything a few years back when they drove it all the way through to Genua. A road is built to follow. Mountain people had always gravitated to the plains, and in recent years Oberwald folk had joined them. Then you got back home. There's money to be made in Ankh-Morpork. Bring the kids. You don't need to bring the garlic, though, because all the vampires work down the kosher butchers. And if you're pushed in Ankh-Morpork, you're allowed to push back. No one cares enough about you to want to kill you. Vimes could just about tell the difference between the Oberwald dwarfs and the ones from Copperhead, who were shorter, noisier, and rather more at home among humans. The Oberwald dwarfs were quiet, tended to scuttle around corners, and often didn't speak Morporkian. In some of the alleys off Treacle Mine Road, you could believe you were in another country. But they were what every copper desires in a citizen. They were no trouble. They mostly had jobs working for one another. They paid their taxes rather more readily than humans did. Although, to be honest, there were small piles of mouse droppings that yielded more money than most Ankh-Morpork citizens. And generally, any problems they had, they sorted out amongst themselves. If such people ever came to the attention of the police, it's usually only as a chalk outline. It turned out, though, that within the community, behind the grubby facades of all those tenements and workshops in Cable Street and Whalebone Lane, there were vendettas and feuds that had their origins in two adjoining mine shafts 500 miles away and 1,000 years ago. There were pubs you only drank in if you were from a particular mountain. There were streets you didn't walk down if your clan mined a particular lode. The way you wore your helmet, the way you parted your beard, spoke complicated volumes to other dwarfs. They didn't even hand a piece of paper to Vimes. "Then there's the way you krazak your gardrga," said Corporal Littlebottom. "I won't even ask," said Vimes. "I'm afraid I can't explain in any case," said Cheery. "Have I got a gardrga?" said Vimes. Cheery winced at the mispronunciation. "Yes, sir, everyone has. But only a dwarf can krazak his properly," she said. "Or hers," she added. Vimes sighed and looked down at the pages of scrawl in his notebook under the heading Oberwald. He wasn't strictly aware of it, but he treated even geography as if he was investigating a crime. "Did you see who carved out the valley? Would you recognise that glacier if you saw it again?" "I'm going to make a lot of mistakes, Cheery," he said. "I shouldn't worry about that, sir. Humans always do. But most dwarfs can spot if you're trying not to make them." "Are you sure you don't mind coming?" "Got to face it sooner or later, sir." Vimes shook his head sadly. "I don't get it, Cheery. There's all this fuss about a female dwarf trying to act like... "A lady, sir." "Right. And yet no one says anything about Carrot being called a dwarf, but he's human." "No, sir. Like he says, he's a dwarf. He was adopted by dwarfs. He's performed the Igrad. He observes the Jakagra insofar as that's possible in the city. He's a dwarf. He's 6 foot high. He's a tall dwarf, sir. We don't mind if he wants to be a human as well. Not even the Drudakak would have a problem with that."
"I'm running out of throat sweets here, Cheery. What was that?"
"Look, sir, most of the dwarfs here are, well, I suppose you'd call them liberal, sir. They're mainly from the mountains behind Copperhead, you know. They get along with humans. Some of them even acknowledge that they've got daughters, sir, but some of the more old-fashioned Oberwald dwarfs haven't got out so much. They act as if Beharian Bloodaxe is still alive. That's why we call them Drudakak."
Vimes had a go, but he knew that to really speak dwarfish you needed a lifetime study and, if at all possible, a serious throat infection.
"Above ground, they negatively," he faltered. "They do not get out in the fresh air enough," Cheery supplied.
"Ah, right. And everyone thought the new king was going to be one of these. They say Albrecht's never seen sunlight in his life. His clan never goes above ground in daylight. Everyone was certain it'd be him.
And as it turned out, it wasn't, thought Vimes. Some of the Uberwald dwarfs hadn't supported him, and the world had moved on. There were plenty of dwarfs around now who had been born in Ankh-Morpork. Their kids went around with their helmets on back to front and spoke dwarfish only at home. Many of them wouldn't know a pickaxe if you hit them with it. At least, if you hit them hard enough. They weren't about to be told how to run their lives by an old dwarf sitting on a stale bun under some distant mountain. He tapped his pencil on his notebook thoughtfully. And because of this, he thought, dwarfs are punching one another on my streets.
I've seen more of those dwarf sedan chair things around lately, he said. You know, the ones carried by a couple of trolls. They have thick leather curtains.
Dradakak, said Cheery.
Very traditional dwarfs. If they have to go out in daylight, they don't look at it.
I don't recall them a year ago. Cheery shrugged.
There's lots of dwarfs here now, sir. The Dradakak feel they're among dwarfs now. They don't have to deal with humans for anything.
They don't like us.
They wouldn't even talk to a human. They're fairly choosy about talking to most dwarfs, to tell the truth.
That's daft, said Vimes.
How do they get food? You can't live on fungi. How do they trade ore at dam streams, get wood for shoring up their shafts?
Well, either other dwarfs are paid to do it, or humans are employed, said Cheery.
They can afford it. They're very good miners.
Well, they own very good mines in any case.
Sounds to me like they're a bunch of...
Vimes stopped himself. He was aware that a wise man should always respect the folkways of others, to use Carrot's happy phrase, but Vimes often had difficulty with this idea. For one thing, there were people in the world whose folkways consisted of gutting other people like clams, and this was not a procedure that commanded, in Vimes, any kind of respect at all.
"I'm not thinking diplomatically, am I?" he said.
Cheery watched him with a carefully blank expression.
"Oh, I don't know about that, sir," she said. "You didn't actually finish the sentence, and, well, a lot of dwarfs respect them, you know, feel better for seeing them."
Vimes looked puzzled, then understanding dawned.
"Oh, I get it," he said. "I bet they say things like, 'Thank goodness people are keeping up the old ways, eh?'"
"That's right, sir. I suppose that inside every dwarf in Ankh-Morpork is a little part of him or her that knows real dwarfs live underground."
Vimes doodled on his notepad. Back home, he thought. Carrot had innocently talked about dwarfs back home. To all dwarfs far away, the mountains were back home. It was funny how people were people everywhere you went, even if the people concerned weren't the people who had made up the phrase, "people are people everywhere," had traditionally thought of as people. And even if you weren't virtuous, as you had been brought up to understand the term, you did like to see virtue in other people, providing it did not cost you anything.
"Why have these traditional dwarfs come here, though? Ankh-Morpork's full of humans. They must have their work cut out avoiding humans."
"They're needed, sir. Dwarf law is complicated, and there's often disputes, and they conduct marriages and that sort of thing."
"You make them sound more like priests."
"Dwarfs aren't religious, sir."
"Of course. Oh, well. Thank you, Corporal. Off you go. Any fallout from last night? No sulphurous, incontinent cats have come forward to confess?"
"No, sir. The Campaign for Equal Heights has put out a pamphlet saying it was another example of the second-class treatment of dwarfs in the city, but it was the same one they always put out. You know, the one with blanks to fill in the details."
"Nothing changes, Cheery. See you tomorrow morning, then. Send Detritus up."
Why him? Ankh-Morpork was lousy with diplomats. It was practically what the upper classes were for, and it was easy for them because half the foreign bigwigs they'd meet were old chums they'd played wet towel tag with back at school. They tended to be on first-name terms, even with people whose names were Ahmed or Fong. They knew which forks to use. They hunted, shot, and fished. They moved in circles that more or less overlapped the circles of their foreign hosts, and were a long way from the rather grubby circles that people like Vimes went around in every working day. They knew all the right nods and winks. What chance had he got against a tie and a crest? Vetinari was throwing him amongst the wolves. And the dwarfs. And the vampires. Vimes shuddered. And Vetinari never did anything without a reason.
"Come in, Detritus.
It always amazed Sergeant Detritus that Vimes knew he was at the door. Vimes had never mentioned that the office wall creaked and bent inwards as the big troll made his way along the corridor.
"You want to see me, sir?"
"Yeah, sit down, man. It's this Oberwald business."
"Yes, sir."
"How do you feel about visiting the old country?"
Detritus's face remained impassive, as it always did when he was waiting patiently for things to make sense.
"Oberwald, I mean," Vimes prompted.
"Dunno, sir. I was just a pebble when we left there. Dad wanted a better life in the big city."
"There'd be a lot of dwarfs, Detritus."
Vimes didn't bother to mention vampires and werewolves. Either of those who attacked a troll was making the last big mistake of its career in any case. Detritus carried a 2,000-pound draw crossbow as a hand weapon.
"That's okay, sir. I'm very modern about dwarfs."
"These might be a bit old-fashioned about you, though."
"Them deep-down dwarfs."
"That's right."
"I heard about them."
"There's still walls with trolls up near the hub, I hear. Tact and diplomacy will be called for."
"You have come to the right troll for that, sir," said Detritus.
"You did push that man through that wall last week, Detritus."
"It was done with tact, sir. Quite a thin wall."
Vimes let it go at that. The man in question had just laid out three watchmen with a club, which Detritus had broken in one hand before selecting the suitably tactful wall.
"See you tomorrow, then. Best dress armour, remember. Send Angua now, please."
"She's not here, sir."
"Blast. Put out some messages for her, will you?"
Igor lurched through the castle corridors, dragging one foot after the other in the approved fashion. He was Igor, son of Igor, nephew of several Igors, brother of Igors, and cousin of more Igors than he could remember without checking up in his diary. Igor's did not change a winning formula, especially if it was green and bubbled. And as a clan, Igor's liked working for vampires. Vampires kept regular hours, were generally polite to their servants, and an important extra didn't require much work in the bed-making and cookery department, and tended to have cool, roomy cellars where an Igor could pursue his true calling. This more than made up for those occasions when you had to sweep up their ashes. He entered Lady Margalotta's crypt and knocked politely on the coffin lid. It moved aside a fraction.
"Yes?"
"Sorry to wake you in the middle of the afternoon, your ladyship, but you did say..." "All right, and?" "It's going to be Vimes, ladyship."
A dainty hand came out of the partly opened coffin and punched the air.
"Yes!"
"Yes, ladyship."
"Well, well. Samuel Vimes, poor devil. Do the doggies know?"
Igor nodded.
"The Baron's Igor was also collecting a message, ladyship."
"And the dwarfs?"
"It is an official appointment, ladyship. Everyone knows. His Grace, the Duke of Ankh-Morpork, Sir Samuel Vimes, commander of the Ankh-Morpork City Wath."
"Then the midden has hit the windmill, Igor."
"Very well put, ladyship. No one likes a short tower of thick."
"I imagine, Igor, that he'll leave them behind."
Let us consider a castle from the point of view of its furniture. This one has chairs, yes, but they don't look very lived in. There is a huge sofa near the fire, and that is ragged with use, but other furnishings look as if they're there merely for show. There is a long oak table, well polished and looking curiously unused for such an old piece of furniture. Possibly the reason for this is that on the floor around it there are a large number of white earthenware bowls. One of them has "Father" written on it. The Baroness Seraphine von Oberwald slammed shut Twerp's peerage irritably.
"The man is a nothing," she said. "A paper man, a man of straw, an insult."
"The name Vimes goes back a long time," said Wolfgang von Oberwald, who was doing one-handed press-ups in front of the fire.
"So does the name Smith. What of it?"
Wolf changed to the other hand in mid-air. He was naked. He liked his muscles to get an airing. They shone. Someone with an anatomical chart could have picked out every one. They might also have remarked on the unusual way his blond hair grew not only on his head, but down and across his shoulders as well.
"He is a duke, mother." "Ha! Ankh-Morpork hasn't even got a king."
1920. I hear stories about that, mother."
"Oh, stories. Sibyl writes silly little letters to me every year. Sam this, Sam that. Of course she had to be grateful for what she could get, but the man is just a thief-taker, after all. I shall refuse to see him."
"You will not do that, mother," Wolf grunted. "That would be 29, 30, dangerous. What do you tell Lady Sibyl about us?"
"Nothing. I don't write back, of course. A rather sad and foolish woman."
"And she still writes every year? 36, 37?
"Yes. 4 pages, usually. And that tells you everything about her you need to know. Where is your father?"
A flap in the bottom of a nearby door swung back, and a large, heavy-set wolf trotted in. It glanced around the room and then shook itself vigorously. The Baroness bridled.
"Gee, you know what I said. It is after 6 change when you come in from the garden."
The wolf gave her look and strolled behind a massive oak screen at the far end of the room. There was a noise, soft and rather strange, not so much an actual sound as a change in the texture of the air. The Baron walked around from behind the screen, doing up the cord of a tattered dressing gown. The Baroness sniffed.
"At least your father wears clothes," she said. "Clothes are unhealthy, mother," said Wolf calmly. "Nakedness is purity."
The Baron sat down. He was a large, red-faced man, insofar as a face could be seen under the beard, hair, moustache, and eyebrows, which were engaged in a bitter 4-way war over the remaining areas of bare skin.
"Well," he growled.
"Vimes, the thief-taker from Ankh-Morpork, is going to be the alleged ambassador," snapped the Baroness.
"Dwarfs?"
"Of course they'll be told."
The Baron sat, staring at nothing, with the same expression detritus used when a new thought was being assembled.
"Bad?"
he ventured at last.
"Gee, I've told you about this 1,000 times, said the Baroness. "You're spending far too much time changed. You know what you're like afterwards. Supposing we had official visitors?"
"Bite 'em."
"You see? Go on off to bed, and don't come down until you're fit to be human."
"Vimes could ruin everything, father," said Wolfgang.
He was now doing handstands using one hand.
"Gee, down!"
The Baron stopped trying to scratch his ear with his leg.
"Do,"
he said. Wolfgang's gleaming body dipped a moment as he changed hands again.
"City life makes men weak. Vimes will be fun. They do say he likes running, though,"
he gave a little laugh.
"We shall have to see how fast he is. His wife says he is very soft-hearted. Gee, don't you dare do that! If you're going to do that sort of thing, do it upstairs!"
The Baron looked only moderately ashamed, but readjusted his clothing anyway.
"Bandits,"
he said.
"Yes, they could be a problem at this time of the year," said Wolfgang. "At least 12, said the Baroness. "Yes, that should—"
Wolf grunted upside down.
"No, mother, you are being stupid. His coach must get here safely, you understand? When he is here, that is a different matter."
The Baron's massive eyebrows tangled with a thought.
"Plan. King."
"Exactly."
The Baroness sighed.
"I don't trust that little dwarf."
Wolf somersaulted onto his feet.
"No, but trustworthy or not, he's all we've got. Vimes must get here with his soft heart. He may even be useful. Perhaps we should assist matters." "Why?" snapped the Baroness. "Let Ankh-Morpork look after their own."
There was a knock on the door while Vimes was having breakfast. Willikins ushered in a small, thin man in neat but threadbare black clothes, whose over-large head gave him the appearance of a lolly nearing the last suck. He carried a black bowler hat, the way a soldier carries his helmet, and walked like a man who had something wrong with his knees.
"I'm so sorry to disturb your grace."
Vimes laid down his knife. He'd been peeling an orange. Sibyl insisted he eat fruit.
"Not your grace," he said, "just Vimes. Sir Samuel, if you must."
Are you Vetinari's man?
Inigo Skimmers, I am to travel with you to Uberveld.
Ah, you're the clerk who's going to do all the whispering and winking while I hand round the cucumber sandwiches, are you?
I will try to be of service, sir, although I'm not much of a winker.
Would you like some breakfast?
I ate already, sir.
Vimes looked the clerk up and down. It wasn't so much that his head was big. It was simply that someone appeared to have squeezed the bottom half of it and forced everything up into the top. He was going bald, too, and had carefully teased the remaining strands of hair across the pink dome. It was hard to tell his age. He could be 25 and a big worrier, or a fresh-faced 40. Vimes inclined to the former. The man had a look of someone who'd spent his life watching the world over the top of a book. And there was that, well, was it a nervous laugh, a giggle, an unfortunate way of clearing his throat? And that strange way he walked.
Not even some toast, a piece of fruit? These oranges are fresh from Clatch, I really can recommend them.
Vimes tossed one at the man. It bounced off his arm and Skimmer took a step backwards, mildly appalled at the upper class's habit of fruit hurling.
Are you all right, sir?
Sorry about that, said Vimes. I was carried away by fruit.
He laid aside his napkin and got up from the table, putting his arm around Skimmer's shoulders.
I'll just take you to the mildly yellow drawing-room where you can wait, he said,
walking him towards the door and patting him on the arm in a friendly way.
The coaches are loaded up. Sybil is regrouting the bathroom, learning ancient Clatchin and doing all those other little last-minute things women always do. You're with us in the big coach.
Skimmer recoiled.
No, oh, I couldn't do that, sir. I'll travel with your retinue.
If you mean cheering detritus, they're in there with us, said Vimes,
noting the look of horror deepen slightly.
You need four for a decent game of cards, and the road's as boring as hell for most of the way.
And your servants?
Willikins and the cook and Sybil's maid are in the other coach.
Oh.
Vimes smiled inwardly. He remembered the saying from his childhood, too poor to paint, but too proud to whitewash.
Bit of a tough choice, is it? He said. I'll tell you what, you can come in our coach, but we'll give you a hard seat and patronise you from time to time. How about that?
I'm afraid you're making a mockery of me, Sir Samuel.
No, but I may be assisting. And now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to nip down to the yard to sort out a few last-minute things.
A quarter of an hour later, Vimes walked into the charge room at the yard. Sergeant Strong in the Arm looked up, saluted, and then ducked to avoid the orange that was tossed at his head.
Sir? He said, bewildered.
Just testing, Strong in the Arm.
Did I pass, sir?
Oh, yeah, keep the orange. It's full of vitamins.
My mother always told me those things could kill you, sir.
Carrot was waiting patiently in Vimes's office. Vimes shook his head. He knew all the places to tread in the corridor, and he knew he didn't make a sound, and he'd never once caught Carrot reading his paperwork, not even upside down. Just once, it'd be nice to catch him out at something. If the man was any straighter, you could use him as a plank. Carrot stood up and saluted.
Yes, yes, we haven't got a lot of time for that now, said Vimes, sitting behind his desk. Anything new overnight?
An unattributed murder, sir. A tradesman called Wallace Sonkey. Found in one of his own vats with his throat cut. No guild seal or note or anything. We're treating it as suspicious.
Yes, I think that sounds fairly suspicious, said Vimes. Unless he has a record as a very careless shaver.
What kind of vat?
Rubber, sir.
Rubber comes in vats. Wouldn't he bounce out?
No, sir, it's a liquid in the vat, sir. He makes rubber things.
Hang on, I remember seeing something once. Don't they make things by dipping them in the rubber? You make sort of the right shapes and dip them in to get gloves, boots, that sort of thing?
Sort of thing, sir.
Something about Carrot's uneasy manner got through to Vimes, and the little file at the back of his brain eventually waved a card.
Sonkey, Sonkey, Carrot, we're not talking about Sonkey as in a packet of Sonkeys, are we?
Now Carrot was bright red with embarrassment.
Yes, sir. My gods, what was he dipping in the vat?
He'd been thrown in, sir, apparently.
But he's practically a national hero.
Sir?
Captain, the housing shortage in Ankh-Morpork would be a good deal worse if it wasn't for old man Sonkey and his penny-a-packet preventatives. Who'd want to do away with him?
People do have views, sir, said Carrot coldly.
Yes, you do, don't you, Vimes thought. Dwarfs don't hold with that sort of thing.
Well, put some men on it. Anything else?
A carter assaulted Constable Swires last night for clamping his cart.
Assault?
Tried to stamp on him, sir.
Vimes had a mental picture of Constable Swires, a gnome 6 inches tall but a mile high in pent-up aggression.
How is he?
Well, the man can speak, but it'll be a little while before he can climb back on a cart again. Apart from that, it's all run-of-the-mill stuff.
Nothing more about a scone theft?
Not really. Lots of accusations in the dwarf community, but no one really knows anything. Like you say, sir, we'll probably know more when it goes bad.
Any word on the street?
Yes, sir, it's Halt, sir. Sergeant Colon painted it at the top of Lower Broadway. The carters are a lot more careful now. Of course, someone has to shovel a manure off every hour or so.
This old traffic thing is not making us very popular, Captain.
No, sir, but we aren't popular anyway. And at least it's bringing in money for the city treasury.
There is another thing, sir.
Yeah?
Have you seen Sergeant Angua, sir?
Me? No, I was expecting her to be here.
Then Vimes noticed just the very edge of concern in Carrot's voice.
Something wrong?
She didn't turn up for duty last night. It wasn't a full moon, so it's a bit odd.
Nobby said she was rather concerned about something when they were on duty the other day.
Vimes nodded. Of course, most people were concerned about something if they were on duty with Nobby. They tended to look at clocks a lot.
Have you been to her lodgings?
Her bed hadn't been slept in, said Carrot.
Or her basket, either, he added.
Well, I can't help you there, Carrot. She's your girlfriend.
She's been a bit worried about the future, I think, said Carrot.
Werewolf thing?
Vimes stopped, acutely embarrassed.
It preys on her mind, said Carrot.
Perhaps she's just gone somewhere to think about things.
Like how on earth could she go out with a young man who, magnificent though he was, blushed at the idea of a packet of sonkies?
That's what I hope, sir, Carrot said. She does that sometimes. It's really quite stressful being a werewolf in a big city. I know we'd have heard if she'd run into any trouble.
There was the sound of a harness outside and the rattle of a coach. Vimes was relieved. Seeing Carrot worried was so unusual that it had had the shock of the unfamiliar.
Well, we'll just have to go without her, he said. I want to be kept in touch about everything, Captain. A fake scone goes missing a week or two before a big dwarf coronation. That sounds like another shoe is about to drop, and it might just hit me. And while you're about it, put the word out that I'm to be sent anything about Sonkey, will you? I don't like mysteries. The clacks do a skeleton service as far as Ubervelt now, don't they?
Carrot brightened up.
It's wonderful, sir, isn't it? In a few months they say we'll be able to send messages all the way from Ankh-Morpork to Genua in less than a day.
Yes, indeed. I wonder if by then we'll have anything sensible to say to each other.
Lord Vetinari stood at his window, watching the semaphore tower on the other side of the river. All 8 of the big shutters facing him were blinking furiously. Black, white, white, black, white. Information was flying into the air. 20 miles behind him, on another tower in Stolat, someone was looking through a telescope and shouting out numbers. How quickly the future comes upon us, he thought. He always suspected the poetic description of time like an ever-rolling stream. Time, in his experience, moved more like rocks, sliding, pressing, building up force underground, and then, with one jerk that shakes the crockery, a whole field of turnips mysteriously slips sideways by 6 feet. Semaphore had been around for centuries, and everyone knew that knowledge had a value, and everyone knew that exporting goods was a way of making money. And then suddenly, someone realized how much money you could make by exporting to Genua by tomorrow, things known in Ankh-Morpork today. And some bright young man in the street of cunning artificers had been unusually cunning. Knowledge, information, power, words, flying through the air, invisible. And suddenly the world was tap-dancing on quicksand. And in that case, the prize went to the best dancer. Lord Vetinari turned away, took some papers from a desk drawer, walked to a wall, touched a certain area, and stepped quickly through the hidden door that noiselessly swung open. Beyond was a corridor, lit by borrowed light from high windows and paved with small flagstones. He walked forward, hesitated, said, "No, this is Tuesday," and moved his descending foot so that it landed on a stone that in every respect appeared to be exactly the same as its fellows, except that the ones around it were not good stones to tread on if it was a Tuesday. Anyone overhearing his progress along the passages and stairs might have caught muttered phrases on the lines of, "The moon is waxing," and, "Yes, it is before noon." A really keen listener would have heard the faint whirring and ticking inside the walls. A really keen and paranoid listener would have reflected that anything Lord Vetinari said aloud, even while he was alone, might not be totally worth believing. Not, certainly, if your life depended upon it. Eventually he reached a door, which he unlocked. There was a large attic room beyond, suddenly airy and bright and cheerful with sunlight from the windows and the roof. It seemed to be a cross between a workshop and a storeroom. Several bird skeletons hung from the ceiling, and there were a few other bones on the work tables, along with coils of wire and metal springs and tubes of paint, and more tools, many of them probably unique, than you normally saw in any one place. Only a narrow bed wedged between a thing like a loom with wings and a large bronze statue suggested that someone actually lived there. They were clearly someone who was obsessively interested in everything.